Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and once more welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain and I'm joined once more by Peter Hart at my gaff.
Your ass.
Morning, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Excellent. And today, Peter, we're continuing, despite requests, the long-running series on Jutland. And this one's entitled The Night Action Begins.
Ooh, doesn't it end?
Ooh, that's a bit of a spoiler, really.
And what date's that, Gary?
It's the 31st of May 1916, I think.
That's perfectly right.
Well, you haven't wished me a happy birthday yet.
It was your birthday weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, true. Now, what's going on? Well, by 2100, that's 9 o'clock, Pete, with the light rapidly fading away, the Battle of Jutland still rested in the balance.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the situation, it's still possible that the High Seas Fleet could be smashed to buggery during the night. Or come the dawn, it could find itself trapped far from home because the Grand Fleet was directly across their chosen escape route. On the other hand, what might have happened to the Grand Fleet?
Well, that could be hard hit during the night by German destroyer attacks or lose more ships in the frenetic uncertainties of night action.
Frenetic uncertainties, Gary.
Or the High Seas Fleet could evade retribution, slip past the vigilant foe, and escape back to port.
Yeah, so are you saying we don't know what's going to happen?
We're saying absolutely we don't know what's
everything's happening. Still to play for.
Two men bore the responsibility of making the command decisions which would decide the outcome. Who are those men? Who are those men?
Masked men.
Were they?
Well, first one was Admiral Sir John Jellicoe. Well, so he knew he had the High Seas Fleet effectively trapped to the west of the Grand Fleet, and he had to decide whether to seek, accept, or try and avoid a night action. So there's the three options.
Given his personality, well, not only his personality, his stated objective, and his determination to avoid unnecessary risk to Britain's naval superiority, this wasn't, in truth, a very difficult decision, was it?
Yeah, he'd already shown earlier in the evening he was going to be careful, especially with regard to destroyers. So he'd prefer not to fight a night action. And this is what Admiral Sir John Jellicoe, aboard HMS Iron Duke, 4th Battle Squadron, says. In the first place, such a course must have inevitably led to our battle fleet being the object of an attack by a very large destroyer force throughout the night. No senior officer would willingly court such an attack, even if our battleships were equipped with the best searchlights and the best arrangements for the control of the searchlights and the gunfire at night. It was, however, known to me that neither our searchlights nor their control arrangements were at this time of the best type. The fitting of director firing gear for the guns of the secondary armament of our battleships, a very important factor in firing at night, had only just then begun, although repeatedly applied for. The delay was due to manufacturing and labour difficulties. Those bloody unions. He didn't say that. Without these adjuncts, I knew well that the maximum effect of our fire at night could not be obtained, and that we could place no dependence on beating off destroyer attacks by gunfire. Therefore, he's turned into Winston Churchill, I noticed there. Therefore, if destroyers got into touch with the heavy ships, we were bound to suffer serious losses with no corresponding advantage. Our own destroyers were no effective antidote at night, since if they were disposed with this sole objective view, they would certainly be taken for enemy destroyers and be fired on by our own ships. The result of night actions between heavy ships must always be very largely a matter of chance, as there is little opportunity for skill on either side. Such an action must be fought at very close range, the decision depending on the course of events in the first few minutes. It is therefore an undesirable procedure on these general grounds. The greater efficiency of German searchlights at the time of the Jutland action and the greater number of torpedo tubes fitted in enemy ships combined with this superiority in destroyers would, I knew, give the Germans the opportunity of scoring heavily at the commencement of such an action.
After deciding to avoid a night action, the next point of decision for Jellicoe was which course to steer. He might not want to seek out and confront the high seas fleet until dawn, but he did not want to prevent them slipping past them. He did want to prevent them slipping past him to the east, which was, of course, in the direction of their home ports. Now, the Germans had a number of options for escape, so let's have a look at them, Pete.
Let's look at it on the map that we've helpfully supplied and then forgot to put up.
Now, the first was to sail back to the northeast, pass through the Skagerrak.
Isn't that a Daisy D?
Well, it's around Denmark, isn't it?
Isn't that a Daisy D, Dozy, Mickey, Beaky and Titch song?
Skagerrak.
No, Skagerrak.
Well, they were going to sail through the Skagerrak, round Denmark, and back to reach the Baltic and safety. Jellicoe had decided to ignore this possibility, as the length of the journey would mean the sacrifice of any ships with severe hull damage.
So the Germans would lose ships. They'd just sink on the way, yeah.
It would also be impossible to cover this route effectively without abandoning other more likely options.
Yeah, so it was an all the eggs in one basket thing. So the second route, now that's via Horn's Reef. That's to the north of the huge British minefields that almost fill the Heligoland Bight. What are the advantages you'd think of this one? I mean, you're an expert on the naval warfare and on the geography of the North Sea.
I'm going to give you a slap.
Ow!
Well, what it did is it offered Admiral Reinhard Scheer the quickest, most direct route to safety, around 100 miles. But it was also a regular haunt of patrolling British submarines.
Well, the third route, now that's the passageway through the minefields the Germans used on the way out. But, how do you find your way to it? When you've been sailing there everywhere, and you've got all the stresses and imposition of a fleet action, you're trying to find a bit of sea. Well, your navigation, it only has to be a little bit out with direct reckoning or whatever it is, and you're buggered.
Another technical term.
There's a lot of buggery in this episode so far.
Now, the fourth route lay via the North Frisian coast past the mouth of the River Ems, which lay about 180 miles away. And it was this option that Jellicoe considered the most likely based on Scheer's last reported position and course of west-southwest. Now, he believed that his dreadnoughts had the speed to prevent Scheer passing in front of him, heading to Ems, and therefore, in accordance with these deliberations, he set a fleet course of south at a speed of 17 knots.
Now, but he's a clever chap, and he has his mind on the other option, so he decides to station his destroyer flotillas 5 miles behind the fleet. Now, why does he do that? Why, Gary? Come on, no time to think, tell me.
Well, it's trying to prevent the High Seas Fleet sneaking astern of the British fleet, heading for the sanctuary of the Horns Reef Channel or the alternate gap through the Heligoland Bight minefield.
So he believes he's getting... he's written off the first option, but he believes that this position covers, one way or another, covers the other three options.
Yeah. Now, he considered, Jellicoe that is, that mass torpedo attacks by his destroyer flotillas would soon drive the Germans back off to the west. Great importance has subsequently been attached to the fact that he failed to issue any specific instructions to attack any German ships they encountered, and nor were they informed of the last known location of the High Seas Fleet.
Yeah, but Jellicoe in turn would contend that it was your obvious duty to attack German ships when sighted, and that the destroyers did know that the High Seas Fleet was to the west. And that's actually all who knew.
Well, he himself.
It's all Jellicoe knew, absolutely. Now, again, just to show that this man thinks of things, what else did he do?
To bolster further the barrier to the Horns Reef Channel, at 21:32, he ordered the fast mine layer Abdiel to proceed to lay a further minefield in that area.
So, he's done all his deliberating. Think, ponder. And at 21:01, he orders the battle line to turn by divisions onto a southerly course. And then 21:17, he orders them to get into their close order formation for night cruising. What's that?
Well, each of the three dreadnought squadrons was to form a column, separated from each other by a single mile, with the sensible intention of staying well within sight of each other to prevent any tragic cases of mistaken identity.
So they're just three big columns with eight in each. At 21:16, Vice Admiral Sir David Beatty, he gets a signal from Jellicoe telling him that the fleet would be adopting a southerly course. And Beatty, at this time, he's 13 miles to the west-southwest. I presume you can picture that in your mind.
Oh, I can, yeah.
Of the main fleet body. And he decides against closing on the main body. Why?
Well, once more, for fear of some disastrous night mix-up.
Yeah, ships turning up out of the night and being fired at. Yeah. There is a slightly amusing thing to this, because where was Beatty in relation to the German fleet?
He was leading the German battle line, although neither side was aware of that.
Yeah, so he wasn't leading as in just ahead, but it was a couple of miles ahead. I don't know how many miles, but he was ahead of them. So they were a bit boxed in, aren't they? Now, so who was the other man who's decided things?
Well, even before Jellicoe's ordered his dispositions, Scheer had also reached a momentous decision, and he decided on his escape route.
There's no doubt that, to give him his full name, Admiral Reinhard Scheer, his situation is pretty desperate, isn't it? At some point, he has to get to the east of the Grand Fleet. And his subsequent post-war accounts, post-battle, are full of posturing, I would describe it as to how he wanted to retain the option to resume battle next day. But there's no doubt in anybody's mind that was the last thing on his mind. And this is what he says. And you're going to be Admiral Reinhard Scheer, who is safely aboard the SMS Friedrich de Grosse.
It might safely be expected that in the twilight the enemy would endeavour by attacking with strong forces and during the night with destroyers to force us over to the west in order to open battle with us when it was light. He was strong enough to do it. If we could succeed in warding off the enemy's encircling movement and could be the first to reach Horn's Reef, then the liberty of decision for the next morning was assured to us. In order to make this possible, all flotillas were ordered to be ready to attack at night, even though there was a danger when day broke of their not being able to take part in the new battle that was expected. The main fleet, in close formation, was to make for Horn's Reef by the shortest route, and defying all enemy attacks, keep on that course.
So he's gone for the second option, the shortest one, the Horn's Reef one. Mainly, I think, because it was the shortest one and because he had ships that wouldn't make any longer.
And Horn's Reef is very much easier to say than the other one.
Yes, that's probably what was in his mind as well. Yeah. You mean Skagerrak?
Yeah. Now, there was to be no diversion. The only real chance of survival was to press on regardless. Speed was of the essence, both to capitalise on the natural surprise of night encounters, but also to prevent the British having any time to react effectively to what was going on around them.
Yeah, I think this is a bold decision, and in keeping with what he'd done throughout. He was risking everything, but at least he had a clear goal in mind, and you could forget the blustering. Escape was his only priority. Now, how does he reorganise his battle line? Well, the Westphalen leading the 1st Battle Squadron was in the van, followed by the 3rd Battle Squadron, with the more vulnerable pre-dreadnoughts of the 2nd Battle Squadron behind them. So that's the order of them. The 2nd Scouting Group is going to act as a cruiser screen ahead, with the 4th Starboard 4th Scouting Group on the starboard wing. Ah, that's the right hand side, Ebra. German destroyers were split up and assigned to search for their prospective prey all across, that's the Grand Fleet, all across the various segments of the battlefield. What does he order the battlecruisers to do?
Well, he orders them to take up station at the rear of the line.
Why at the rear?
I have no idea. Because they were in a bad way, weren't they, by that stage?
That's it, Gary. You've intuitively grasped the whole thing. And now you're going to be our favourite. Commander Jörg von Haas of the SMS Derflinger.
A stubborn struggle was waged against fire and water. Although as far as possible everything inflammable had been taken out of the ship, the fire continued to spread, fed principally by linoleum, the wooden deck, clothing and oil paints. About 9 o'clock, we had practically mastered the flames, the only smouldering in a few isolated the fire only smouldering in a few isolated places. The Caesar and Dora turrets were still smoking and giving out clouds of thick yellow gas from time to time, but this gradually ceased after the ammunition chambers had been flooded. No one could ever have believed that a ship could endure so much heavy fire.
Yeah, tough ships, aren't they? And although the fires are under control, she's in no real state for any sort of night action should they have encountered destroyers, or in fact anybody. And Jörg von Haas goes on to say this.
Only the Derflinger and the von der Tann took station in the rear of the line. We certainly did not feel very well suited to this station. Our starboard was our best side, for it still had all 6 15-centimetre guns intact. But one single searchlight was hardly enough. On the port side, only 2 15-centimetre guns were still in action. We should, therefore, have to urge the English destroyers to confine their attacks as far as possible to the starboard side. There, we were still capable of administering a cold douche.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's quite funny. He does have quite a good sense of humour, doesn't he?
He's a good bloke. The course set by Scheer means that the High Seas Fleet are essentially on a collision course with the Grand Fleet. The Grand Fleet is steering south, and they've got to, they're coming across them. So there's a sort of, it becomes a V becomes an X, if you understand what I mean. So, they've got this 100 miles of perilous water before the Germans can reach the Horns Reef Channel. The question is, what would happen when they cross the path of the Grand Fleet? And exactly who's going to be waiting for them? Is it going to be the battleship? Because the Germans don't know. Is it going to be the dreadnoughts? Is it going to be the battlecruisers? Or is it going to be destroyers and light forces? Well,
the die was cast.
Gary!
As the German fleet swung round to their new course, the natural result was that they started to gradually part company with Beatty and his battlecruisers, who were directly ahead of them, but still persisting on a southerly course. For the battlecruisers, Der Tag had ended, although, of course, they were not yet aware of that.
Now, they'd been in a lot of intense fighting, the battlecruisers, and so they begin the grisly task of collecting up the rest of the wounded. Unhindered, they can do it. Wandering about the ships must have been dreadful, and they got some bizarre and horrible sights. As you know, we may be looking for things, but there's horror mingled with humour, isn't there? And this is leading seaman Alec Tempest, who was aboard... What a great name. I wish I was called Alec Tempest. He was aboard HMS Lion of the 1st Battlecruiser Squadron. He says this, passing through the Stoker's mess deck, first aid parties were bringing wounded Stokers up from the engine room. One of them had his leg blown off of the knee. He was yelling his head off, "Where's my bloody leg? Where's me bloody leg?" Repeatedly. The leg was eventually recovered, and he was found to have the Stoker's roll of banknotes tucked into his sock. The money was obviously of more importance than the loss of his leg. Fantastic. I do like that story. But on the other hand, the guy's lost his leg, and actually, the story doesn't matter. He could well have died of shock that same night.
Now, the Grand Fleet had some problems in taking up their designated night cruising stations. Mostly, this was caused by the damage inflicted on the Marlborough by the successful torpedo strike against her, which reduced her speed to 17 knots.
Yeah, and so she was part of 6th Division. That's the 1st Battle Squadron. So they keep station with her. The four dreadnoughts of 6th Division drop back. They're eventually 4 miles behind the main body of the fleet, remember, which is in three columns. And somebody else takes station with them. Who?
Well, the 5th Battle Squadron, they also took up a station in the gap between the main formation and the 6th Division.
Acting as a sort of link then, yeah.
Then the 4th Light Cruiser Squadron screened ahead of the Grand Fleet.
You've got the 2nd Light Cruisers Squadron to the west.
So everything's ready, and at 21:27, the destroyer flotillas began their move to their allotted stations at the rear of the Grand Fleet.
Now, what state are these destroyer flotillas in, would you say, Gary?
A number of them had not yet been in action during the day and were thus as ready as they would ever be to face the challenges of the night ahead. Unfortunately, the British destroyers had not been trained in the different skills and procedures essential for effective night fighting.
Yeah, so this is important. So before we get onto the night fight, we need to talk about this, Gary. The policy of the Royal Navy, whenever possible, was to avoid the risks and imponderables of night action. And had they adopt, how had they, that's a policy. And do you know what? I don't actually argue with that. What do I argue with?
Well, they consequently adopted a head-in-the-sand approach to it. Jellicoe, who, you know, we mentioned this, with a great trainer, had an unfortunate blind spot when it came to night fighting and had lamentably failed to make any proper preparations throughout the Grand Fleet.
Yep, so they had unstable low-level shuttleless searchlights, they had no star shells, they had rudimentary night identification signals, and there was an all-pervasive confusion over the importance of the dual defensive and attacking roles that destroyers might have in a night action. And this is all a recipe for confusion. But the Germans were much better off. Why were the Germans better off?
Well, they too were wary of the problems posed by a fleet night action. But in their situation as the weaker naval power, it had been recognised as imperative to make the most of any opportunities that might occur under cover of darkness. Very sensible, I would say.
Well, the first advantage was that they got proper searchlight controls. They stationed high up. Why is it important height with searchlights?
Well, it's going to be above the swirling smoke that's likely to mask any low-level positions.
Now, there's something even more important about their searchlights, and that is that they had proper shutters. Irish shutters, they were called. But what does that mean? Why is that important? You're technical-minded.
Well, it means that the searchlight can warm up to full power behind the shutters before being opened up at a full blaze onto their targets. And they could also be switched off and covered in a moment should the situation require it. It's instantaneous, isn't it? Closed, bang,
yeah,
light gone.
Oh, as the British have to warm up. And it's like a lot of the lights have to warm up so they don't come on at full beam. Interesting, that. The Germans had another advantage. We mentioned star shells.
Yeah, they'd successfully introduced them, which had the great advantage of simultaneously illuminating and dazzling their target at a distance without revealing their source to the enemy.
Now, the Germans hadn't got director control of their secondary batteries. That's the 5.9 or, in British case, 6-inch guns on the German dreadnoughts.
Neither side had they?
Yeah, but the Germans had done something about night firing with their secondary batteries. What was that?
Well, through night practice, they'd achieved a far higher ability to concentrate their fire effectively onto any target that suddenly revealed itself before them. practice, practice.
Now, the next bit's really interesting and stupid. They seem to have... The British recognition signals we'd said were simple. There was another disadvantage to them. What was that?
Yeah, the Germans seem to have known at least part of the British night recognition signal. This has often been attributed to a startling lack of common sense displayed by the signal team aboard HMS Lion. At 21:32, they signalled to the Princess Royal by flashing lamp, asking for a reminder of the night recognition signal. Please give me challenge and reply now in force as they have been lost.
Now, unknown to them, there were some German light cruisers, because remember, they're quite close to the German fleet. Some of the German light cruisers saw this and intercepted at least part of those signals got the response. Now, this is not necessarily crucial in one way. It's more a sign of how stupid they were, because the signal was so simple that actually the Germans could work it out and pass it between them pretty simply anyway. But it's just another sign of how shit the British were, the Royal Navy was, at night fighting. And while we... Let's have a think about that for a moment, Gary. A little break while we think about that.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Overall, the German system of recognition signals was far superior, as it involved a more complicated sequence of coloured lights that could not easily be replicated.
Yeah, if you haven't got the coloured lights ready, you can't do it, can you? Now, it's perhaps fortunate for Jellicoe. There is a bit of good news for the British in this, and what's that?
Well, Scheer's destroyers proved almost totally ineffective in their task of hunting down and destroying the Grand Fleet at all.
Yeah, it's dark. That's always a surprise
to me. Inky darkness, I think, is how it's described,
yeah.
Pete.
They had no precise bearings or sightings on which to base any search, and the German destroyers just couldn't find
them. They can't find them.
We're all day.
Now, the dark night was by no means silent.
Was it uphill?
No, yes. No one knew what was happening with any degree of certainty, and all were aware that once a shell or torpedo had been dispatched at a target, it couldn't be recalled if the target proved to be friendly.
Yeah, if you fire a torpedo, you can't go, it's the war spite. Bring it back.
And at the short ranges of night action, the risks of opening fire in haste and repenting at leisure were evenly balanced against the rewards for getting one's retaliation in first.
You always get your retaliation in first. I've noticed that. Yeah, a couple of well-directed salvos or a torpedo, it can finish a night action before it's bloody begun, couldn't it?
Yeah, but it's it was so easy to make a mistake. I'm not saying anything.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Smothered by a blanket. I wish you were smothered by a blanket. Smothered by a blanket of uncertainty and fear, both fleets edged awkwardly into the night.
Ooh.
Moving like wraiths through the dark, the British destroyer flotillas took up their position 5 miles behind the main body of the Grand Fleet.
Now, as they did so, you've got to imagine the High Seas Fleet is moving towards them. They're diagonally towards them, and eventually they'll cross their path. Their course, Gary, what's their course? Come on, tell me.
South, south, east, three quarters east.
Do you know what that means?
That way.
And I can see what he's just...
I'm pointed in exactly the right direction.
Exactly the right direction.
Now, even before the...
Towards the Spurs ground.
Yes. Even before the destroyers had completed their reverse turn back onto their southerly course behind the Grand Fleet, there were small-scale clashes as elements of the respective probing destroyer and light cruiser shields bumped into each other.
Well, at first, the British barely noticed they're under attack, under threat. Then the trouble really starts. At 9:50, the 4th destroyer flotilla, that's actually in the act of reversing course. They sail one way and then go back to get onto that southerly course behind the main fleet, the Grand Fleet. Now, as they swing round, the Garland, that's the 4th in the line, sights 4 German destroyers. So what happens?
The German destroyers were cautious as they thought the murky shapes could be their own second flotilla. They hoisted their designated recognition signals, but as they got no response, without further hesitation, fired a torpedo each and turned away.
Now, the Garland seems to have been the only one of the 4th flotilla that was aware of the threat, and she briefly opens fire at a little effect before turning away. The German torpedoes were sighted but successfully evaded by both the Garland and the Fortune. So another destroyer, the Fortune, in that line sights them. Now, there's a similar clash. That might make very little sense to people, but it's just showing the confusion, how different ships in a line see things or don't see things. It's all confusing. There's another similar clash. When's that?
That's at 21:58, so 9:58, as the 11th flotilla was moving into her night station at the rear of the Grand Fleet. They were sighted by the Frankfurt and Pillau of the 2nd Scouting Group at a range of only around 1,000 yards. Now, the 2 German light cruisers may have mistaken the British destroyers for light cruisers, but in any event, they silently fired a torpedo each and turned back into the dark night without being sighted by the British.
Wow. What happened to the torpedoes?
Well, the British were lucky because the torpedoes missed as they turned back onto the southerly course to follow the fleet.
So it's only that big change in course that saved them. Now, a few minutes later, another sign. It's going to be a busy night, Gazza.
Gazza, yes. At 22:05, so 10:05, they bumped into more of the 2nd Scouting Group. Once more, the British ships may well have been distracted by the complications of their manoeuvres onto a new course in difficult circumstances. And this is Lieutenant Heinrich Bassenge aboard SMS Elbing of the 2nd Scouting Group. And he says this. In the dark, we saw in an easterly direction the shadows of English ships, the Castor with their 11th flotilla. We showed them English recognition signals, which they acknowledged. As we were sure that it was the enemy, we opened up heavy fire from about 1,000 metres distance. Castor returned fire straight away and turned back. So he's actually making reference to using those English signals.
They seem to have shown the correct first 2 letters of the British recognition signal. They got the rest wrong, but they got enough right. This character's an interesting chap. It's a strange name.
You mean Anon Officer?
Ted Anon Officer.
Aboard HMS Castor of the 11th Flotilla. And this anonymous officer says this.
They fired only at us, being apparently unable to see our destroyers, which were painted black. We were hit 4 times. One shell hit the forecastle just under the bridge and bursting inside made a hole about 5 feet in diameter, and the splinters from it wounded a large number of men in the 4 ammunition lobby. One shell went right through the 4 mess deck and burst outside the disengaged side of the ship. One hit the motor barge, bursting in her and setting her on fire. Another shell hit the disengaged side of the forebridge and wiped out everyone in the way of signalmen, messengers, etc., who had gathered there, with the exception of one man. This man had a miraculous escape, the 4-inch shell bursting practically between his legs. Crikey, Gary. But all the force of the explosion must have gone in the direction in which the shell was travelling, for it blew a large hole in the deck of the bridge, and through this the man fell. Sorry. He landed on another man who had been killed by that same shell, but he himself was practically unhurt. Beside these direct hits, the ship was covered with splinter dents from shells which burst on hitting the water short, and several men in the midship guns were laid out by them. We fired a torpedo at the leading Hun, and the two after 6-inch guns, which were not being directly fired at, were making very good practice at the enemy. Now, so this is the light cruiser Castor, and it's worth... But the Germans seem to have aimed at the bridge when they opened fire. Why would they aim at the bridge?
Take out the officers and
yeah, command and control.
Command
yeah.
and control, yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, behind the Castor, all aggressive instincts amongst the 11th Flotilla were strangled by doubt, even when the Elbing and Hamburg switched on their searchlights and opened fire.
Mm. Yeah, so most of them do bugger all, although the Marne and the Magic... both managed to fire just one torpedo. The rest of the destroyers are just totally bemused. Why are they bemused? Why, Gary?
Well, the stabbing, blinding lights, the indistinct shapes, they all conspired to paralyse them.
Now, they've been praying to meet these bloody German ships for years. So what? They're just 1,000 yards away. Why?
Well, the searchlights themselves provide an ideal target for torpedoes.
You mean they can see where the searchlights...
They can see it, yeah. But
where they're shining from.
They embrace any excuse to avoid action. Dazzled and blinded, they were afraid that the Castor had made a dreadful error of judgment and was pouring shells into friendly ships. And so they did nothing.
Now, Commodore Hawksley, he's on the Castor. Commodore James Hawksley. And he just seems to... considered the whole incident as being closed. And this is what he said.
The flotilla then proceeded south after the battle fleet. My object being to be within reach of the fleet at daybreak, should the fleet have found the enemy and a fleet action take place.
Now, he doesn't turn after the Germans. He just thinks, oh, well, next day there'll be a fleet action. I need to keep my powder dry, so to speak. Whatever his reason, and you know, we've got to be understanding of the confusions of it all. But whatever, he's missed an opportunity here, hasn't he?
Yeah. Now, Hawksley could not communicate with his destroyer captains.
Why not? Why not, Gary?
Tell him what was happening.
Why not?
As the first German salvos had disabled his wireless and signalling lamps. Only a vague report was ever sent into Jellicoe, which omitted any details of the position, course, or identification of the German ships that were encountered.
So pretty bloody useless.
Just a few minutes later, at 22:20, the 2nd Light Cruiser Squadron under Commodore William Goodenough was pursuing a southerly course a little to the east of the 11th Flotilla.
So further across towards Germany.
Having seen the recent 11th Flotilla skirmish, Goodenough was aware that the German ships were in the vicinity.
Now, this is quite exciting. Lieutenant Harold Burrows, he's at the after-gun control of the Southampton when he sees a line of mystery ships sailing across on a slightly converging course. And this is what Lieutenant Harold Burrows on the Southampton says. We three light cruisers were steaming along, guarding our battle fleet from destroyer attack when we fell in with 5 German cruisers. It was a very tense moment while we were trying to make out in the dark whether they were friends or foe. Wow. Now, who are these mystery ships?
They were the light cruisers, the Stettin, München, Frauenlob, Stuttgart and Hamburg, all of the German 4th Scouting Group, who were closely followed by the Elbing and the Rostock.
Now, why are they there? Well, the German screen, they're also having troubles. They've not been able to take their correct positions. And both the 2nd Scouting Group and the 4th Scouting Group had drifted in error, in essence, to the port side of the High Seas Fleet. Now, this is a really dodgy situation because they can't see what's happening. Now, Goodenough's aware it's dangerous. He's aware of the perils they're facing. So what does he do?
Well, Goodenough brings his ships to the highest state of readiness, guns loaded and trained on the potential targets, torpedo tubes at the ready. On the bridge of the Southampton, he bore the ultimate responsibility for making a decision.
What information has he got to base that decision on?
Well, unfortunately, only minimal information and no really compelling evidence either way.
Oh dear! What we've got here is it's a game. It's the one who loses their nerve or keeps their nerve.
It's a game of nerve, is what you're trying to say. The first to break and formally challenge the other would cede the advantage
because the other would say, "Oh, their enemy in open fire." Wow!
As the ships gradually converged in rising tension, it seems that both sides lost their nerve almost simultaneously in an exchange of challenges at about 22:35, that's 10:35. It was like a sharp pin burst in a balloon. And this is Lieutenant Stephen King Hall aboard HMS Southampton.
"We began to challenge. The Germans switched on coloured lights at their yard arms. A second later, a solitary gun crashed forth from the Dublin, which was next astern of us. Simultaneously, I saw the shell hit a ship just above the waterline and about 800 yards away. As I caught a nightmare glimpse of her interior, which has remained photographed on my mind to this day, I said to myself, 'My God, they're alongside us.' At that moment, the Germans switched on their searchlights and we switched on ours. Before I was blinded by the lights in my eyes, I caught sight of a line of light grey ships. Then the gun behind which I was standing answered my shout of 'Fire!'"
Wow. Now, the gun teams of both sides spring into action. Being in such close proximity, in an instant, the shells did terrible execution. And you're once more going to tell us what Lieutenant Harold Barrows aboard the Southampton said.
"Apparently, they made up their minds at the same time as ourselves, for at the same moment that the Commodore ordered us to open fire, they switched on their searchlights and opened fire on us. The ships astern were unmolested, and all five ships concentrated on us. We received a most intense fire which killed or wounded all my gun crews so that we were practically helpless to reply to their fire." Wow. Now, this is almost unprecedented in naval fire for a modern ship. And there's a real concentration of German fire. They're not just firing at the Southampton, they're firing at the Dublin as well. And that makes matters even worse, doesn't it? This is at ranges that are almost like Napoleonic times, like the wooden walls of old England, except now they're bigger guns and wow.
And this is once more Lieutenant Stephen King Hall aboard the Southampton.
"The range was amazingly close. No two groups of such ships had ever fought so close in the history of war. There could be no missing. A gun was fired and a hit obtained. The gun was loaded. It flamed. It roared. It leapt to the rear. It slid to the front. There was another hit. But to load guns, there must be men. Flesh and blood must lift the shells and cordite and open and close the hungry breaches. The flesh and blood cannot stand high explosive. And there was a great deal of high explosive bursting all round HMS Southampton's upper deck from her after screen to the forebridge. The range was so close that the German shots went high, just high enough to burst on the upper deck and around the after superstructure and bridge. And in a light cruiser, that's where all the flesh and blood has to stand. So in a very few seconds, my guns stopped firing, all through lack of flesh and blood. It was a great pity. In fact, the Sergeant Major, with a burnt face, and myself seemed to be the only bits of flesh and blood left standing." Flesh and blood, eh?
The process was by no means one-sided. As she was returning fire, the Southampton even managed to launch a torpedo. It ran true and struck a mortal blow. Midshipman Stoltzman was at his station on the upper bridge of the Frauenlob. And this is Midshipman Stoltzman. "I at once switched both available searchlights onto the cruiser opposite us. The guns immediately opened fire.
This was followed by such a furious rain of shell, which nearly all hit the after part of the ship, that it looked as if several enemy ships were concentrating their fire on us. A few seconds later, I heard a shout, "Fire in the after part of the ship!" And then, only a few seconds later, a terrific crash there, with the characteristic tremor of a ship which has been hit by a torpedo. We had been torpedoed.
Now, down below, down in the engine rooms, the water rushes in, and any damage control efforts are just overwhelmed by the mass of water. And this is machinist, stoker, whatever, Max Müller of the what ship was he again?
SMS Frauenlob. Frauenlob. At the same moment, both engines stopped, probably owing to damage in the propeller shafts. The light went out and there was a roar of water pouring in. As I followed the sound to find out where the hole was, the water was already rushing over the floor plates, so that it was no longer possible to locate the hole. I went on deck and inquired through the speaking tube to the starboard engine room whether the engine room was still intact. The chief engineer replied, "We will try to get rid of the water from the port engine room." This took some time, and meanwhile the action was proceeding on the port side with unabated fury. The ship had a heavy list to port. At the same time, the water was rushing over the deck and flooding the port side.
Now, meanwhile, Midshipman Stoltzman, he's left the upper bridge and he moved about to the aft. This list to port, you can't miss it. He didn't miss it.
And this is Midshipman Stoltzman aboard SMS Frauenlob. "For the first minute, the ship merely seemed to sink slightly, but after that it went down rapidly. On reaching the after bridge, I barely had time to fasten on a life belt and glance hastily at the havoc in the after part of the ship. A shapeless mass of wreckage, cowls and corpses. Before the water reached the deck of the after bridge, and I threw myself onto a raft which was floating in the angle between the fore and aft bridge and the after bridge. I found two men who with great difficulty helped me to clear the raft from the fore and aft bridge, so as not to be caught in the latter. A few seconds later, we saw the ship sink without any internal explosion. Some of our guns continued firing when the gun layers were already standing in the water and the ship was sinking. As the last tremor ran through the vessel, 3 cheers for His Majesty the Kaiser rang out."
Yeah, it's another example of the bravery shown by the German sailors. What the casualties? Dreadful, I expect.
Well, the Frauenlob took with her to the bottom all but 5 of her crew of over 320.
Oh, now, the Southampton's been fighting hard, but she's been peppered from end to end, hasn't she?
She suffered under the heavy concentration of German fire and received no less than 18 direct hits. And once more, you're going to relate what Lieutenant Harold Burrows aboard Southampton says.
"On top of this, the ship was heavily on fire forward, amidships and aft. In the darkness, it was rather an appalling sight, and I think we all made up our minds it was the end. Luckily, we got a torpedo off at their leading ship, which I'm certain was a Frauenlob, which sank her." Ha ha ha! He doesn't say that. "This, I believe, is the reason they retired after 3.5 minutes. I personally am very glad they did, for we could not have stood much more." Wow.
Now, below decks, the effect was incredible as the shells crashed home time and time again. And at this range, as you've mentioned, very few missed. And this is stoker Andrew Stewart aboard HMS Southampton. "The shell fire was very heavy and some of the shells hit in one side of the ship right through and out the other side. The sick bay was badly damaged. I was standing by a fire main between decks near the big racks. I thought it was a stupid place to stand, so I got at the back of the racks, and just then a shell came through the ship's side. My 6 mates were killed by a piece of shrapnel and I was hit in the forehead."
Wow. It's an example of someone making a decision for no and just saving their life.
Saved his life.
Now, boy telegraphist Arthur Gash was standing by the main wireless office as the battle began. And this is what he said, on the Southampton. He says this: "It seemed as if all hell was let loose. Shells bursting, projectiles thumping into the ship's side and the coal bunkers. This lasted for about 5 minutes and stopped as suddenly as it began. Then the wounded casualties began to be brought down. One, a leading stoker, was helped into the wireless transmission office. He had his right leg shot off just below the knee and was bleeding badly. I tried to help to stop the bleeding by pressing my weight in a vital spot. Then a sick bay attendant brought a tourniquet and he was removed to the ward room, which was being used as a casualty ward. Then my job was to clear up the blood and mess in the office. Not a nice job at all." Now,
shaken by the sudden loss of the Frauenlobe, the Germans withdrew into the protective cover of the night. As the action ended, the Southampton metaphorically licked her wounds.
Remember when Fred used to lick his...
Metaphorically again. Now, in just a few short minutes, the Southampton had suffered some 89 casualties, of whom 36 were killed.
Yeah, and remember, with naval casualties, they weren't light wounds. A lot of those wounds would be bloody serious wounds. And this is what you're going to be stoker Andrew Stewart aboard HMS Southampton, what he says.
"As one young boy lay dead, Commander Rushton looked at him and said to Goodenough, 'He's died a glorious death.' Admiral Goodenough said, 'So long as England lives.' When I heard that remark, it made me think what it was all about."
Yeah, and you know, the modern mind sometimes sneers at things like that, but that is what it was for these people. That's what it was just. That was what it was. And I think quite touching, really. So the night action has begun, and what's going to happen next, Gary? What's going to happen next?
Would the high seas fleet be torn apart by British destroyers?
Would the high seas fleet escape into the night?
Could the German battle cruisers ever get home?
Tune in to the next podcast for the denouement.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wow.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?